For our last session of the conference, I'm delighted to introduce Michaelis Michael from the University of New South Wales, who's going to be talking to us on implicit commitment. Welcome, Michaelis.
Hi. Hello, all. Before I start, I just thought we should officially thank Luca for organising this event, and I'd like to thank him personally for inviting me along. So if you join me in thanking Luca. Okay, so implicit commitment, that's the topic. Well, actually, it's implicit ontological commitment. I'll be reverting to some points that Uriah made early on, and I'll be trying to actually talk about ontological commitment. From my point of view, a lot of the papers that have transpired so far have not actually been about ontological commitment. They've been about theory choice, and that's a completely separate issue. I'll be trying to say a little bit about why and how there nevertheless is a substantive question to ask about the nature of ontological commitment, and I'll try and say something about what we should say about it. So Quine revived a kind of metaphysical project. It was a project that the positivists thought they could destroy, and first Carnap, then Quine came to see that actually there's something that could pass by the name of metaphysics that we should still be interested in, and that was what he called ontological commitment. And the key role of this notion is to spell out what it is according to a theory exists. So the question then is, under what circumstances do we specify what according to a given theory exists? And notice that that will be a subset of what that theory says as a whole. So the Quinean understanding then involves doing this for your own theory, involves crucially a kind of housekeeping in the home theory. And the role of the home theory for Quine is really, really important. The thing to remember is that this home theory is that by which you explain everything else, including the semantic theories that you're going to have as part of your theory. So a sentence like "there exist Fs," if it's in your home theory, it's that we will be using to explain existential quantification, for example. It's not the other way around. And that's an important point that I think doesn't often get emphasised. The home theory is the standard by which we make sense of everything else. And if we're interested in a theory's ontological commitments, then what we're worrying about is what it is that exists according to that theory. And as I said, this is a special case of the problem of the consequences of theory as such. Right, so then we face, oh no, let's go the other way, or not. Okay, so in a theory, there are explicit statements, explicit commitments, and then unless it's already that the theory is presented, is closed under consequence, then there are further consequences. They are the implicit commitments which follow from the explicit commitments. And on this picture of theories, then what you have is a total set of commitments, some explicit, some implicit, and you get the total set by closing the explicit under some sort of consequence relation. That consequence relation, just about everyone agrees, is going to be entailment. But entailment, what's that? there's still significant debate about what entailment is. And starting, and so far, what I've said, I think, is Quinean through and through, right? I think I've presented what Quine thinks of as ontological commitment, and I think I've presented what Quine thinks of as theories and the way they work, and I think I've presented what Quine thinks, how you get total theory out of your explicit commitments. I haven't said quite what he says entailment is, and so when I do that, I'll present his view and I'll break away from it like others do, but so far I claim, yeah, I'm just doing textual analysis more or less, but more than that, I'm applauding it. I think what Quine did in presenting this sort of account of theories and their commitments is absolutely correct, even if he goes wrong in this very slide. Maybe. I can't remember what's on this slide. We'll see. No, that bit's right too. So I do want to say that I do think that Quine's account of the story is right up to now. Okay, where was she? And there's a further question, right? Given that I've given this general account of what ontological commitment is, it's a further question, what sentences get into my home theory? Right, it's a further question, what the substantive character of my home theory is. Is it going to be given by some austere picture given by physics, or is it going to be a more inclusive Hugh Price type picture? In fact, I would go that way too. Those sorts of substantive questions about what your theory is, which theory you should choose, are not decided by your picture of ontological commitment. The picture of what ontological commitment is the framework within which theory choice takes place. And the existential claims, the ontological claims, are those that get into the theory once you've made that choice. The claims themselves are the ontological commitments, right? This is the important thing. And Quine talks loosely. He uses his semantic ascent and semantic descent quite easily. But remember, he has a kind of deflationary account of truth, so he's able to do that quite easily. So when he talks about there being Fs, the statement there are Fs entails the existence of Fs or requires the existence of Fs. That's, you should treat that as another way of saying the same thing as endorsing the sentence in the home theory, there are Fs. And that's the fundamental thing, right? And, of course, this is a general account of what it is for a theory to have ontological commitments. We can use numerous theories, say in different contexts, and for different purposes. We can use different theories that have different standards for the claims that claims need to meet for them to earn their keep. We might have different pragmatic considerations that determine which sentences get into which use of which theory. That's all consistent with what Quine says. Right? In fact, it makes best sense of what he actually does with respect to, say, the intentional idioms. Because, as we all know, he wants to say that they're pragmatically ineliminable, right? But on the other hand, they don't get into austere science. So, that's not me, is it? Somebody else. So that looks like a contradiction if you think that there's just one theory that's going to do all the work. But there's no reason for a pragmatist or someone who endorses the Quinean picture of ontological commitment to make that further claim. Right? So these standards, these different standards, these different pragmatic considerations, different pragmatic goals that we have, are just like degrees of confidence or degrees of precision we use. These are pragmatic choices, and because of that, not liable to be wrong. Right? They're not just not the sort of thing that could be false. But the question of what a theory has as its ontological commitments is a completely separate question of whether we should be endorsing the theory or whether we should rationally adopt it given where we are and what the evidence is that we're confronted with. Separate question altogether. And mostly what I'll be talking about is just the question of what a theory's ontological commitments are. So far, again, I'm just spelling out, I think, what Quine has in mind, and reacting to some of the things that I've heard, emphasising the depth and importance of what Quine has shown us. So he says they're closed under entailment. So do I, so does Jackson, so does Lewis. But what Quine says about entailment, I think, is wrong. He thinks it's a narrowly formal notion, and that we identify valid inferences as those which, under substitution of the non-logical vocabulary, never takes us from true premises to a false conclusion, which is curiously similar to Bolzano's account offered in the 1830s, I think. But given that account and the slipperiness of translation, that means there's no clear notion of formal consequence for our natural language, according to Quine. And it's for that reason that he wants to regiment our natural language claims into a first-order language that we can do this permutation move on. But the crucial thing is to see the role of entailment as giving you all the consequences, the commitments of the explicit commitments in the theory. And so ontological commitment then, on this understanding of ontological commitment, which I claim is Quine's, this is a feature of total theory. Right? It's a feature of, and this is something I think that Jonathan emphasized, and I think was exactly right, and maybe other people have emphasized this too. This is an inclusive notion, if your theory is inclusive. Right? And again, we have different theories, and for different purposes we could use different theories. And some of the questions about paraphrasing that, I say questions about theory choice. Right? Which theory should we be choosing here? Not straightforwardly questions of what the ontological commitments truly, really are. That's the technical notion there. So accepting, again, the existential claim is the ontological commitment. Right. So the sentence itself is the commitment. Right. And to reiterate, the sentences of your home theory, the ones that you sincerely and wholeheartedly endorse, are the base in terms of which we're going to make sense of everything else, including our semantic theory. So to think that we're going to be looking to see whether in our home theory we are referential or not by looking at our semantic theory gets things back to front. Our sincere assent to there are Fs in the home theory is that in terms of which we make sense of everything else. So Quine's account says, look for these narrowly formal valid consequences, and among them, look for the ones that look like that. There are Fs, and they're the theory's ontological commitments. Work, you bastard. Okay. I and Jackson and Lewis all think, and I think all right-minded people, basically think that this picture, with constraints, let's just bracket away the count of entailment, basically we think Quine's got it right. This is the right account of ontological commitment. I, Jackson and Lewis disagree with Quine about what consequence is, logical consequence in general. What I want to do is to look at Jackson and Lewis, what they say about the consequence relation, and I want to show how they get it wrong. Okay, so Jackson's alternative account is disagrees with Quine over the nature of entailment. And what he emphasizes is not the narrowly formal account of validity, but rather necessitation. So according to Frank, P entails Q roughly, well, exactly, if P necessitates Q. And that is that P entails Q if the set of P worlds is contained within the set of Q worlds. And, you know, we tell our kids this when we teach them, don't we? We say things like, an argument's valid if it's impossible for the premises to be true with the conclusion false. Right? We use modal notions in explaining validity. Oh, how we lie. Yeah. So that's their basic account, and it's an intuitive account that Frank runs. But it's liable to various sorts of objections. Frank identifies an objection and shows that he can answer an objection. Let me give these arguments before I work here. Consider these two arguments. Frank discusses this in a paper called A Problem About Ontological Commitment. So, consider those two arguments, and consider David Lewis as an example, who's both a materialist and a modal realist. If there are non-actual possible worlds, then it's necessary that there are. So both arguments would be necessitations, right? Because both arguments have a necessary conclusion. But, says Frank, there's a difference in the way Lewis is committed to non-actual possible worlds by his materialism and by his modal realism. Right? So there seems to be a difference. His materialism is committed to possible worlds because that there are possible worlds, according to David, was necessary. But his modal realism is committed to possible worlds in a much more wholehearted way, in some sense. Even though they had the conclusion has the same metaphysical status. So Jackson, like any sensible person, feels that there's an asymmetry between those arguments and tries to explain, using the necessitation relation, what a necessitarian would say in response to this intuition. And what he does is, I think, really interesting. What he does is he focuses, and I think he's right too, I think he focuses on the dynamics of our commitments. So what he says is that both of them are, according to Lewis's total theory, arguments to necessitation. So the inferences are necessitations. But he emphasizes that doubt about the conclusion does not reflect in the same way on the premises of both arguments. So, for example, okay, imagine that. Ah, there it is. It's hard work, this, giving a paper, isn't it? So, doubt about the conclusions, the shared conclusions of the two arguments, reflect differentially on the premises. If you were to doubt the conclusion, then it would reflect on C1 and B2. Right? It wouldn't reflect on the same premises. So what he showed then, by focusing on the dynamics of belief, is how, even if you thought that these were necessitations, that the doubts about the necessary conclusion would reflect differently on the premises used to derive those conclusions. So I think what Frank did there was exactly right, and that what he has identified is an important phenomenon, and it's available to anyone, because analogous problems will crop up all over the place for anyone who has views about things that are logical entailment that could be logically necessary as conclusions. And what he's done is, I think, importantly, to show that there's an asymmetry you can find even in what look to be structurally very similar arguments. And I think that was a really important thing that he did. But there are other important problems with the necessitation account. Okay. You've seen this before. Okay, so look at these two arguments again. There's another difference between them, and that is the role of the second premise in each case. Remember, this second premise is necessary. So by the lights of a necessitation account, it's redundant. But then the first argument looks invalid without that necessary premise. But this again is a general feature of necessitation, right? You can always drop you can always drop a necessary premise from a necessitation, and what you get is a necessitation. Right. This is a general phenomenon in logic. Whenever you have something that is logically true, whatever logically true means, usually, actually, there are some weird logics where this doesn't happen, but in any sensible logic, then you can use something like a cut and remove it and end up with something that is also logically valid without that logically true premise. So for example, in this argument, A is F, A is identical to B, therefore B is F. That, let us suppose, is a necessitation. Suppose we agree with Kripke, as we should, that rigid designators with an identity sign between them is, if true, necessarily true. So an identity statement is, if true, necessary between rigid designators. Therefore, the second premise is necessary. Therefore, second premise, if that's a necessitation, can be dropped. It's redundant. Therefore, FA entails, or therefore, from FA it should follow necessarily the FB, and certainly it does. But you should balk at the idea that that's a good argument. FA, therefore, FB, you should be balking, right? That's not a good argument. The argument without D2 is far from persuasive. As an account of validity, we would say that that is not a valid argument. And part of what we mean by that is that it is no rational failing to not know D2. We know that from Kripke, right? It's an a posteriori necessity. So it's not a rational failing not to know D2. But that means it's not a rational failing to fail to infer D3 from D1. But that means you could know the premises of a necessitation and it not be a rational failing that you didn't infer the conclusion. Right? So insofar as we're looking for an account of logical consequence, necessitation is hopeless. And we lie to our students, right? Because it's not about what's possible, right? In this case, it's just not possible for A to be F and be the case that B is not F, if they are in fact the same thing. Necessarily, that B must be F. So we don't say the truth to our students when we say that thing in first year. And what this tells us is that there are necessary truths that are not eliminable from the premise sets of arguments which make them valid, like, for instance, D2 here. And that shows that necessitation doesn't work as an account of entailment. So Jackson's wrong. So now I want to sort of sketch an alternative. Remember where we are. We're looking for an account of entailment that can feed into this Quinean picture of giving total theory from your explicit statement of your theory. And so Frank's account of necessitation as account of entailment, of it as an account of ontological commitment, as a species of commitment in general, fails, I say. So all that stuff in from metaphysics to ethics about entry by necessity, all that, just wrong. But yeah, whatever. On the necessitation account, we saw that contrary to the sensible view that failing to acknowledge your commitments is a rational failing, that on the necessitation view, there are always going to be commitments of a theory that are not rationally accessible. So the necessitation account fails to make sense of the way commitments are tied up with rationally assessing agents. To make sense of that, what we need is an account of consequence that ties it to what's rationally accessible. And a fancy term for that would be the a priori, I reckon. Where am I supposed to point this? Ah. Enter will do it? Ah, oh, okay, even easier. Let's try that. Ah, oh, so good. Okay, put that down. okay. This shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. All right? Anyone not hiding in Canberra. We have known for a long time that the a priori and the necessary have got not just a different intention, but a different extension. We have known that for an awfully long time. Morton White, way back in the 50s, showed us the former. Kripke showed us the latter in the early 70s. The necessitation account fails to give an account of logical consequence, since it fails to give an account of the way failing to acknowledge your commitments is a rational failing. And on the necessitation account, there are going to be commitments that are not rationally accessible. But for these, the failure to acknowledge them does not show the agent to be in any way less than rationally ideal, I say. So if you like, we could define a priori consequences, the a priori consequence of an interpreted sentence to be the consequences a rationally ideal agent would acknowledge. And now, acknowledging doesn't mean assenting to, right? As we saw from Marx's paper, you derive a contradiction, that's a consequence of something you're committed to. That might give you reason, because it's a consequence of your theory, to revise back. Acknowledging it as a consequence doesn't mean endorsing it. It means acknowledging that you are now incur a debt. Now you've got to either revise up or accept, or throw your hand up in the air and not know what you're going to do, but at least it's your intention. You can't blithely say, oh, look, another true contradiction. Marx doesn't want to do, which is, I want to know why he's not happy with that. But anyway. Notice also, when we talk about rationally ideal agents, we don't have to assume that they are omniscient. Right? So in particular, if someone was assenting to A's F, and they're rationally ideal, then they're not necessarily going to be able to infer B is F. Right? It depends on what you can get to a priori. And it's a further question how we can spell out this notion of the a priori, and I'm not going to deal with that now. Except, I think, am I going to? Yeah, except for this. The two-dimensional analysis is clearly wrong. And I'll just give you a very quick argument for why it's wrong. This should be everyone should know this, because this is sort of standard knowledge in the literature on modal logic, but curiously gets ignored. The diagonal of a necessary the diagonal proposition when you do your Stallnacker thing is either going to be necessary or contingent. So it's either going to be a string of zeros or a string of ones, or it's going to be some ones and some zeros. So according to the two-dimensional account, every sentence is either going to be a priori or a posteriori, depending on whether it's got a necessary diagonal or not. Yeah? And a priori here means also a priori false, the case where you've got just a string of zeros. So far, so good. So bad for the two-dimensional analysis. Because on this account, then, the two-dimensional analysis partitions the set of interpreted sentences into a priori and a posteriori. But the distinction between the a priori and a posteriori doesn't partition the set of interpreted sentences. What it partitions is the set of knowable sentences, right? A priori, a posteriori mean a priori knowable. A posteriori knowable, not a priori true, right? So there may well be sentences which are not knowable. They're either true or false, right? But in which case, those sentences are neither a priori knowable, nor are they a posteriori knowable. They're just plain not knowable. Okay? So this two-dimensional analysis fails. This is obvious. I don't know why people don't pass on and get on to some serious philosophy. But anyway, there's a stronger case to make against necessitation if we can show that there are inferences which are entailments and not necessitations. In that case, what you could do is block my account, which says that what we need to do to get things right is to add an epistemic restriction to the necessitation account. Say, for example, we say that entailments are those necessitations which, such that an agent who assents to the premises while denying the conclusion is rationally criticizable. There's a typo. But if there are examples of the contingent a priori, then we're going to be able to find cases of a priori consequences that are not necessitations. I think that there are such examples of the contingent a priori. I'm convinced by Kripke that that's so. So I think that necessitation, though an interesting relation, right, it really is an interesting relation, but it's not an account of entailment. Okay, so now what we've got is an account of what a theory's ontological commitments are, and it's in terms of those consequences that are a priori consequences of the explicit statement of the theory, and it's those ontological commitments in particular are going to be the existential claims that are such consequences. So the only twist from Quine really is a different account of entailment. And I claim that's an important difference. But nevertheless, we ought to acknowledge Quine's important role in this. So we've talked about what it is for a theory to have commitment. And for a theory, what it is for a theory to have ontological commitment in particular. But what is it for one of us to have commitments? Because, right, typically when people talk about commitments, ontological commitments, they're interested in what commitments they should have or what commitments their opponent has. So the interesting question then is, what is it for a person, not a theory, but a person, to have ontological commitments? Well, here I say, in concert with lots of other people, that people get ontological commitments by dint of the theories they commit themselves to. But the important thing here is that there are many types of relations we can stand in to theories. Not all of them are going to be of the sort that make us incur those sorts of commitments. So, for example, someone who, say, is committed deeply, you know, to Einstein's theory, but is using Newtonian theory to design a bridge, you might think, okay, this is not someone that's committed to the Newtonian theory. Van Frassen is another who thinks that the attitude we should take to theories and scientific theories in general is something short of belief, something short of that attitude that brings with it ontological commitments. So we should, he uses the term acceptance. He says that we accept a theory when we believe, now we do have a belief about it, namely that it's empirically adequate, but on top of that, because we could think a bunch of theories that are empirically adequate, we take on a commitment to engage in research using the theory, etc., etc. That's what Bass says, and Bass thinks that acceptance is not belief, so the attitude you take to the theory is not belief, therefore the ontological commitments of the theory aren't necessarily yours. Whether Bass is right about that, far from clear about, because I'm far from clear about whether that particular strategy of saying this is a non-belief attitude that we can take to a theory, whether that's success. But this strategy of trying to find non-belief but belief-like attitudes is relatively common in the history of philosophy. Just to pick one example, almost at random, not quite, because I wanted to mention Michael Frater, who sadly died recently, is ancient skepticism. And Sextus Empiricus, in his Outlines of Pyrrhonism and Against the Professors, distinguishes two ways in which you could assent to a judgment, to the very same impression. The way a skeptic assents and the way the dogmatist assents. Frater, in a couple of very important papers, argued that this was a distinction in attitude, not in contents. Now, of course, Miles Bernier came back saying, no, it's all about contents. I actually think Frater's right about this. But however you read them, the suggestion that it's a difference in attitude to the same content that marks whether you take on the commitments, the ontological commitments, or not, is of the same sort that we saw in Bass von Frassen. So we can take lots of attitudes to theories. We can entertain theories. They drink so much, no. We can act as if they're true while professing to disbelieve them if asked. Right. We can treat them as a fiction. Or three dots. Taking those attitudes does not commit us to the commitments of the theory. There are commitments we can incur. So, for instance, the theory could talk about theories, and by taking an attitude to it as a theory, we thereby take on commitments to the existence of theories, but you know, wave that aside. And although many accounts proliferate non-committing attitudes, and I do want to allow them in principle, I'm emphasizing that there are these many different attitudes, I typically think that the work philosophers have done in distinguishing the attitudes they're interested in from belief is illicit. I mean, Basf and Frassen's the clearest example there. Once he says enough about taking on the theory and using it to engage in the world, in your encountering with the world, and believing it's empirically adequate, and using it to design your experiments, and thinking in terms of it, etc., you start thinking, well, just why isn't it belief? Because you reckon that you've got these strong, clear picture about what could rationally justify a belief, and you realise that that's not what justifies you taking that theory on. Sounds like it's belief, and you're doing it for reasons that you can't justify. Anyway, so I do think that typically philosophers have put too much weight on what the nature of beliefs has to be. So, for example, I don't even think it's obvious that the physicist I was talking to you about before does not believe the Newtonian theory when he uses it. I mean, when I gave it to you, what I said was he doesn't really believe. Right? But I think that sort of use of that term really is very suspicious. We should worry whenever we see philosophers using that. And it's a further topic that I won't have time to discuss here now. But where are we? Nearly at the end. Thankfully, you're thinking. So, ontological commitments then of a theory are a subset of the commitments of the theory in general. Metaphysics is a kind of tidying up, a housekeeping in the home theory, what we're really going to assent to. And that the commitments are the entailments of the theory. So far, so good. Then we saw Quine's narrowly formal account of entailment. There's not much chop. They argue, Jackson and Lewis argue for necessitation, not much good either. What we need is an account that makes sense of the way failing to acknowledge commitments is a rational failing, and so commitments that must be epistemically accessible, term for that a priori. And there are two kinds of analysis we had to give of our ontological commitments. First, we had to give an account of what theories say exist. Then, the second thing we had to do was to say what was involved when we believe a given theory. But we also needed an account... Oh, I said that. Yes, what we believe. I haven't offered anything like an account of the second, but I reckon believing would be implicated, as Hume says, as the ground of all our actions. I think he's absolutely right about that. Or, like Ramsey said, maps of neighbouring space by which we steer. But again, that's another story. Ta-da. Right, it necessitates without entailing. Yeah, right. Exactly. Right.
So now about the criteria, it seems that some of the weaknesses of the necessitation criteria still carry over, and in particular that the
if but remember, it's got to be a priori that there are sets. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what its status truly really is, but I agree. I absolutely agree with that. And in a more considered presentation, where I was trying to tease out just what we're wanting to do and what role we want that notion of rational criticizability to play for us, I'd be concerned to distinguish between inferences that are self-evident and those that aren't. So I think there are other epistemic relations that we need to wheel in to make sense of the sort of distance between the theory that we're interested in and the a priori consequence, for one thing. The other thing is, I think that is also a phenomenon that I pointed to that Jackson emphasized, and I said that what he noticed about the dynamics of belief, about how doubts about the conclusion reflect back, I think that is absolutely correct. I think what Jackson noticed there is right, and I think it applies in this sort of case exactly. So, and I don't think it applies in an unvariegated way. I think there are degrees of doubt and of how doubts about sets would infect different parts of physics, for example, different parts of biology. And I think that they're not all in the same ballpark. And I think that's something that we need to be sensitive to. So I think Jackson did us all a favour when he tried to defend the indefensible. What do I say, or what does?
Or would you say Jackson has offered us a strategy to explain away the alleged?
What Jackson did in defending necessitation was to show how the doubts about the claim about something which is allegedly necessary reflect backwards in different ways on different premises, and so showed something about how the dynamics of commitment can be used to explain intuitions about arguments that differentiate apparently structurally similar arguments. And I say what he did there with respect to necessitation was correct, even though necessitation fails as an account of entailment. That any account of logical consequence needs to be sensitive to this phenomenon that Jackson points to, not just necessitation. Any account needs to be sensitive to the way in which a logically true conclusion doubts about its being logically true can reflect differentially to the premises of arguments that allegedly show that it's true or logically true. So I think what he did there is of use to all of us, even though he was defending a false theory.
Finger from Britain.
So understand the notion of a priori. Every logical theorem is a priori.
Yep.
Is that a problem for that view?
Is that a what? Sorry.
Is that a problem for your view?
No, don't think so.
Of course, every logical truth will be a priori field.
Yeah.
By anything, right?
Right. But as I was saying, there are other fine-grained epistemic notions we can have.
But that wouldn't be the a priori.
No, that's right.
Okay,
but I think you show yourself to be less than rationally ideal by denying any a priori truth. But that means that all of us are less than rationally ideal. Oh, well, that's a big discovery. But there are there's more or less criticizable. And so what we need is an account of what that involves. It might be that the a priori is the closure under self-evidence, self-evident truths by self-evident inferences. And the closure of that is not going to be, it might be the a priori. This is a substantive thesis now that I'm not necessarily defending here.
Well, so you would redefine what the a priori means in terms of?
Well, you'd have to give some account of why we have epistemic access to what's a priori. Right? And if you need some story about that, but that doesn't mean that everything that's a priori is equally self-evident.
Right. So what you would need is a notion of self-evidence and not
a priori. But you need to link them up in some way. Yeah. But that would be a substantive account that I'm not offering here. All I'm offering here is the general claim that what we need is an account that feeds into a theory of rational criticizability. Once I've got that, that's all I need for this sort of little argument.
Dan.
So on the 2D point,
yep.
I just did DVM's concept course.
I don't know it, but anyway.
Say
again? I don't know that course.
Oh, it's just mainly on 2D stuff.
All right, okay.
And that argument wasn't on the syllabus. So
no, curious that, wasn't it?
I'm curious about the argument, and you ran through it pretty quick. And
yep.
So I'm just wondering if you could indulge me and just sort of go through it again.
I'll try. I'll see if I can get...
No,
what do I got to do? Maybe if I use this. Oh, yes. Is it working? Yes. Yeah. So there's a quick argument. It goes like this then. The diagonal proposition, you define a priori as having a necessary diagonal. Then there's two cases. A priori true, a priori false. Okay, just a priori for short. Every interpreted sentence, because it gets the total function, will get either a necessary or a contingent diagonal. But that means every sentence will either be a priori or a posteriori. But a priori and a posteriori don't partition the set of interpreted sentences, unlike this 2D picture. They partition the set of knowable sentences. Right, what we should all notice is that maybe you can fix the 2D account. What we need clearly is an account of epistemic access. So we need to restrict the 2D analysis in some way. I say that might well be right, that we need to build this epistemic access in. But in that case, the real interest is in this epistemic access story. That's where the account of a priori knowability and a posteriori knowability is going to come in. Right? And not in the 2D story. So I say that a priori distinction isn't well modelled by the 2D account. What I think the 2D account does do is it shows the consistency, the formal consistency of certain claims that Kripke makes. But it's clear, if you read carefully, that Kripke doesn't like the 2D story and Stalnaker doesn't like it, even though as an account of the a priori, he rejects that. Lots of people do. But curiously, this never gets said.
Okay, in the back row, is that Uriah?
Yeah, but my question is stopped.
Your question has been answered?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then Tibor.
Okay, two points. The first one is a slightly trivial point, I guess. You talked earlier in your presentation about being able to hold multiple theories.
Yeah, or take different relations to different theories.
Yeah, let's say that I have one theory that I hold, which is that 2 + 2 = 4. But there's another theory that I might hold that 2 + 2 = 5.
Mm.
I somehow find it awkward to have any sort of ontological community to both of them at the same time. So I think rather the only ontological commitments I make are ontological commitments for my home theory, and I might do them via other subsets of my home theory. But the only ones that I'm truly ontologically committed to are the ones that I've embraced in my home theory. And if I have subsets, sub-theories, well, that's okay, but I'm not going to ontologically commit to any of those if they contradict my home theory, clearly, because I don't think I can entertain the contradictions. I can't make sense of the...
I think that's a line you could run. I think that's Quine's line.
Mm-hmm.
I think he, when he talks about the intentional, he says that they're pragmatically ineliminable, but he doesn't want them in his austere theory that's liming the nature of reality. So he's sort of in your situation when
so
he talks about.
How do I depart from that?
I depart from that because I deny that you. You do just have the one home theory. I say, and I think Hugh probably has this line, runs this Quinean line too, that in different contexts, you will use different theories, different accounts of the world, and you will act as though they were the true accounts of the world.
Not if I knew, well, I mean, I could be ignorant or unaware of the fact that I'm being inconsistent, and I put my hand up, I'm often inconsistent. But if I really knew that I was being inconsistent, I really knew that, well, 2 + 2 was either 4 or 5, I wouldn't go through life saying, okay, well, it's now 5:20, so I'm going to commit to 2 + 2 being 4. But at 6 o'clock, I'm going to commit to 2 + 2 being 5.
I'm not sure that I get that part of your question. What I take to be a serious question is, take the physicist who's building the bridge. I say, and contrary to what I think some people would say, that the physicist, when he's using the theory and acting in light of that theory, actually believes that theory at that time. Someone might come along and ask them questions that pops them into a different frame of mind where they're asked about the principles they were using and they say, oh no, at best these are approximations, but also they're not just approximations because the theory really doesn't work, all right? Now, I say, one picture is the sort of, David Lewis used to say that in that person, there's their real beliefs and then the way they're acting, and those aren't genuine beliefs. My view is, no, the emphasis on what they really believe is a philosopher's fiction. I don't think there is such a thing as what they really believe. There's what they believe in this context and there's what they believe in that context. And neither of them is what they really believe. It's not like you get what a person really believes when you ask them the question with a gun pointed to their head, right? Where there's no context in which they truly reveal what their true beliefs are. I mean, the beliefs are not like that. I think they're much more fluid. And so I would say about your scenario that there are, in different contexts, different theories that you commit yourself to, and you show that by the way you act, so.
Well, they're fluid over time, in that tomorrow I might believe something different to what I believe today.
Yeah.
But only if I've learned something in the meantime.
Mm.
If I've learned nothing at all, then I would expect my beliefs tomorrow to be the same as they are today. But we can argue about that one later. Let me quickly make my second point. I'd like to also...
Oh, was you going to come in on that, or...? Okay. Yep.
Okay, yeah, I was going to make a second point. I was going to offer you a different view of necessitation.
Yeah.
And how we use ontological commitment to underpin our theories, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simpler view in that the way I make ontological commitments is I commit to those things that I feel I need to commit to in order to make sense of my experience of the world. And I only commit to them and nothing else. I don't have to worry about which theory I'm using. I don't have to embrace theories. All I have to do is say I have a sum total of my life experience, whatever that is, and I need to make sense of it to myself somehow. And the way to do that is I have to make some ontological commitments. If I say, I believe that today is Saturday, then I'm going to say, well, at a minimum, I must commit to my own existence, because otherwise I wouldn't ever say that today was Saturday. So I have to make some sort of ontological commitment, otherwise my assertion that I can say anything at all, let alone I'm saying today is Saturday, is undermined by the fact that I don't think I exist. So the kinds of ontological commitments that I want to make are those that are necessary in your sense of necessitation, if you like. They're necessary, but they're necessary just for me to make sense of my world, whatever that world might be.
Well, two things. First, you're talking about theory choice, not what ontological commitment are.
I only have one theory.
Yeah, but you're talking about how you choose a theory, like, for instance, that today is Saturday. You're not talking about what the ontological commitments of a theory like this, today's Saturday, are. You're not giving me an account of, for any theory, what determines its commitments, and amongst those commitments, its ontological commitments. But also, I think you're treating ontological there in the bad old way, and not reckoning that you're not taking seriously what Quine thinks about our commitment to a theory. Our commitment to a theory is our commitment to the world being that way. And so they're all, in a sense, ontological in that sense. But we distinguish certain of our commitments as, and we call them ontological commitments, simply because they're claims that there are such and such. So I'd make both those points in, as a response.
Finger up, Brian.
Yeah, I just need a clarification on that very point, and you're skirting it, but you don't quite get it for me.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably just a subtlety that I've missed, but you made it clear that ontological commitment is innate to the theory once.
Well, I didn't say innate, it's internal to
it. Internal to the
theory,
but not a priori theory in terms of something belonging to agents.
Say it again.
Not a priori to the theory, not external to the theory then?
Not external to the theory, yeah.
Not external to the theory. How is that different from that? So in some of the later slides you described sort of theory selection based on different attitudinal stances,
yep,
in terms of buying, etc. How is that not at least, I'm missing the subtlety or distinction, how is that not at least related to an ontological commitment of sorts external to the theory?
Okay, so there's a general question. What do you close an explicit statement of a theory under to get all of its commitments? And how do we identify the ontological commitments amongst them? The substantive account I've given is an answer to that question. There's a further question we can ask. When are we as individuals and agents committed to a theory and by dint of such commitment take on ontological commitments amongst all the commitments that we take on when we take on a commitment to a theory? Okay. So in the sense in which it's in ontological commitments are internal is the sense in which those commitments, ontological commitments, are among that total set of commitments that that theory has. Right? And when we take on a commitment to that theory, we are committed to that total set. Okay, so in that sense. Now, theory choice, different attitudes we can take to a theory are pragmatically guided stories that we tell about how and why we would choose which theory in which context and how we switch between them. And I do think that it's right to say that we do focus on ontological commitments of a theory in choosing a theory. I think that's right. I mean, that's part of comparing different theories. It matters whether in this theory you get to paraphrase chairs away, in this theory you don't. You know, that might be a criterion we use to choose between two theories. And that's guided by all sorts of pragmatic considerations. But what I was emphasising about the a priori was that it comes in determining the total commitments of the theory. And in such a way that it makes sense of the way in which someone who fails to acknowledge a consequence of their explicit theory has shown themselves to be rationally criticizable. That's why I needed the notion of a priori there.
Okay, it's still, to some extent, and again I could be missing something, it's to some extent still sounds like hyper-intentionality, and that goes to somebody else's question there. When you're talking about the contingent and necessary intention, as Jackson has it in Snellander's tables, the question, the sentence not knowable, if you like, is that relevant to the 2D analysis in the first place? And if it's
well, it is. If it's, I mean, you've got to somehow make them come out as neither a priori nor a posteriori, right? Because they're neither. And if your account doesn't do that, then you need to supplant your account with another one that's going to rule them out somehow.
Okay. Broadly speaking, a sentence that's not knowable is then relevant to a theory, yes?
Is going to be knowable, is not
it's
relevant.
A sentence that's not knowable, how
yep.
is it relevant to a theory? Sorry, I understand how simplistic my view.
It may not be, but the thing is that I remember dialectically where we were. We're at the point where I've tried to show that the notion of the a priori or rational criticizability in the ideal is the key notion here. And so we need an account of the a priori. And along the way, what I want to say is, and don't get sucked in by those TDists because they've got it wrong, right? We need a substantive epistemic account of knowability.
It's one possible. That again, speaking in terms of hyper-intentionality, that your knowledge may well change, empirically speaking, a posteriori, and then therefore you just do another 2D analysis that reflects. Is there a problem with that? With
Well, you need to tell me the story. I mean, what you, there's like, this is like Chalmers, right? Chalmers presents his account twice. Once as a 2Dist, and then in terms of conceptual possibilities and what's a priori possible. And says, and magically they're the same, right? But it's not magic. Just show me how they do come to be the same. So I say, do the substantive work of showing me that they work, given that we have this argument that shows that they partition the wrong sets. It might be that you can add to the a substantive epistemic account that does the work that needs to be done to show that it partitions in the right way the set of knowable truths. Well, if that's done, great. I say, though, that the substantive account you've given me of epistemic status is what's going to be doing a lot of the work, not the nice little model. But that's always, you know, dust in the eyes. And it's been that way since this 2D stuff first started with Humberstone and Davies. Right? It's the same mistake was in there.
Lloyd.
Stuff I really liked about it, Dan. Consider the following case in which I tell somebody, I'm going to show you, or reason it out, that there are only four primes between 10 and 20. So I say, 11th prime, 13th prime, 17th prime, 19th prime. There are no more primes there, so there are only four. Pretty good argument, right? Now, I think you quite rightly say that for that argument to really work as an argument, as a piece of reasoning, we need in there that sentence which says there are no more primes between 10 and 20. There are no more, right? But that is a necessary truth, and that is a priori. So I think you quite rightly say we're supposed to be entitled to drop it. But if we drop it, it doesn't look like we have a very good piece of reasoning.
Okay, now that's actually an argument against me, though, notice.
I don't think so.
Oh, no, I think so. Right. Because what you've shown is that there are suppose you're right that there are no more primes between 10 and 20 is an a priori truth. Then I say, because entailment actually is, let me just go through this. What entailment actually is an a priori consequence. Then anything that is itself a priori can be dropped from the premise set, and what remains will still be a priori. And so I say, yes, that is. Of course, the argument's less obvious, but it's still a priori. It's not as self-evident, but it's still a priori. Why? Well, because if you're right that there are no more primes than those that you've listed between 10 and 20, if that really is a priori, then you could have a separate argument that established that.
Yeah.
And so what I say is, so though that argument is less obvious, it's still a priori and still valid, still entailment.
I thought it actually supported your point. Because
no, it was an attack, but you know.
A priori is necessary, and it certainly looks as though in a piece of reasoning, right, to the conclusion there are only four primes between 10 and 20, you'd really have to stick that in there. But
what I'm suggesting in response is that you don't. Right, you don't really need to stick it in there. It makes it more obvious, but it's still an a priori argument because you can get to that as a side argument, not as a separate premise.
You think as long as the necessity...
The a priority.
No, I'm sorry. Did you think that as long as the necessary truth in a set of premises is also a priori, then you can...
No, it doesn't need to be necessary. All it needs to be is a priori. If it's a priori, then you can derive it a priori.
You do think that the ones that are necessary, according to Jackson's view, can simply be removed and the argument is still...
Necessary.
Yeah, it's still necessary.
Yeah.
I thought what you were saying was, these guys are wrong.
Yeah, they are.
To say that a necessary truth can be dropped, right?
Yep, I agree with that.
And I thought, since I take it that there are no more primes between 10 and 20, is itself both a priori and necessary.
Yeah, and it's the fact that it's a priori that allows you to drop it.
And I've got a finger on this point. I mean, you can take it further, presumably, because it's going to be a priori that 11 is prime, for example.
Yeah.
So all you end up is saying that the following is a valid argument.
Yeah.
Therefore, there are four primes between 10 and 20.
Yeah. Less obvious, yeah. But still a priori.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, this is the point about self-evidence and a priori not being the same thing. A priori, if you like, on one way of cashing it out, and I think this was Lewis's favourite way, is the closure under self-evident and consequence of what's self-evident. So that doesn't mean that all a priori arguments are equally obvious, but they have to be such that someone who denies the conclusion is showing themselves to be rationally criticizable.
In my case, isn't the person who, if I don't explicitly say there are no more primes, if he said, well, I don't see that follows, you only mentioned four.
Yeah.
And is he now screwing up rationally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, clearly. But not as obviously as if that additional premise was there. Right? They are rationally criticizable. They've denied something that's a priori true, but it might not be an obvious a priori true.
Wolfgang.
Yeah, so coming from Canberra, let me attempt to defend the Judea account.
They're used to doing impossible things there.
So, one thing to realize here is that the philosophical use of a priori a posteriori is far from univocal. If you look at how it's been used throughout the history, even in recent times, the definitions vary, and it's far from clear that there's one notion. And if you leave philosophy, it gets, of course, much worse. So the standard can't be any account of a priori and a posteriori must exactly match what everybody else has said about it. So we have to deviate from various uses that are on the table, otherwise we get an inconsistent usage. And it seems to me that one account that makes some sense is the one that you have, for example, in Davis' two-dimensionalism, where a priori is defined as a sentence is a priori, if and only if it expresses a belief that, in some very strong sense, can be justified independently of experience. That's kind of close to what people said, so it deserves the name. And then he says, and a sentence is a posteriori if it is not like this. So now a posteriori and a posteriori are exclusive and extend through the whole area.
Which whole area, though?
Of all sentences.
No, hang on. You just said, and let me just quote you, that it can be justified independently, right? So that's an epistemic notion.
Right.
Now show me how the two-dimensional account gets that justification in.
Just finish the first one, then I'm
yep.
That. So the first one is, now we have one thing to realize is the a posteriori group now contains, so the a priori and a posteriori now are not modifying knowable sentences, right?
No, how you just used justification before,
right.
And that's an epistemic notion.
I'll get back to this. Just give me the first point, which is now it should not be a requirement on a priori and a posteriori that they only devise the knowable sentences.
Well,
there may be one use from which they do that, but there's another perfectly acceptable.
Have you displayed that one? I didn't hear that one. Did you display it?
Pardon?
Did you display that use?
Yeah.
When was it? I missed it. You talked about justification.
Yeah.
Which is an epistemic notion.
Yeah, right.
Right, so show me the account that doesn't involve justification or epistemic notions.
I don't want to do that. I want to make two points. The first point is we can have a reasonable a priori, a posteriori distinction where the a posteriori, a priori sentences, predicates do not only divide the knowable sentences.
Well, is that a point or a claim? Because to me that's just a rejection of patent. You know, philosophical tradition of using a priori and a posteriori to modify ways of knowing, right? Now, and you're just saying, no, we don't do that anymore because we're from Canberra, we do it differently. We're claiming the word.
I'll get back to the a priori point in a second, but let's just look at an example. Take an unknowable sentence. So the best candidates are like Fitch-style sentences. There are so and so many stars, and nobody knows that there are so and so many stars. I don't think that it is absolutely clear that this is not a posteriori.
I'm
kind of a pre-theoretic, if there's any such thing.
We could take that. I mean, you might, but here you're saying that. Well, I'm not convinced that those are best type cases. I think that mathematics gives us cases which we might think are neither knowable nor sort of not knowable a priori, a posteriori. And moreover,
that's a case where we have proved that it's unknowable for mathematics. It's kind of like up for grasp. So that, in that sense, it's a clear case of it. And it's a case, the Fish sentences, that I think kind of if you ask people like who on any pre-theoretic notion, it's just not clear that those sentences, there are so and so many stars and nobody knows it, are clearly not a posteriori. There's an intuition.
Right, but that's because they're knowable, is that right?
No, they're not.
They're not knowable.
We have Fish proof that they're unknowable.
So why do you say that they're not unknowable?
Pardon?
So you want to say
no,
they're
I
not?
I say they're unknowable, we have a proof, but it's not totally clear that they are not a posteriori. On the kind of pre-theoretic, if there's such a thing, notion of a posteriori.
But if there's a proof that they're not knowable, how can you? You might think that, you know, ex falso quod libet can't be valid. But look, here's the proof. And what do you do then? Do you act like certain people and think, oh no, we've got to reject it, or do you say, oh yeah, look, it is provable? You might have thought it wasn't provable, in the same way you might have thought it wasn't knowable, and so it wasn't unknowable. But here's a proof. It's unknowable. Learn to live with it.
And which shows what?
Well, if you say the Fitch proof shows that it's unknowable, then contrary to your pre-theoretic view that it's knowable and a posteriori knowable.
No, my pre-theoretic view was that it is that it is a posteriori and unknowable.
And therefore, a posteriori and knowable. A posteriori and unknowable.
Yeah.
I think you're talking about it being empirical and, or at least a contingent and unknowable. You're running continually.
Anyway, let me get back to the first point.
Okay.
A priori defined in terms of expressing a belief that is justifiable independently of experience.
Okay.
Now, I don't think you should ask somebody like Dave to give a non-epistemic definition of a priori. His whole point is that can't be done. A priori is an.
Well, I disagree with that. I agree it can't be done. But if you don't think it can be done, then the two-dimensional models don't do the work for you think they're doing.
Well, you can't define a priority in terms of an independently defined two-dimensional matrix. That's totally true. And somebody like Dave would immediately agree. Sure, the primary changes are defined epistemically. So you can't like get clear about, without any epistemic notions, get clear about this is our two-dimensional structure of this in the sentence, so now we read off epistemic claims. Rather, the primary notion, it's explicitly defined in terms of a priority. So it doesn't do the work, the strong work of like giving that, epistemic notions out of nothing.
Yeah,
but
yeah. If you build in the epistemic story, and you start from the epistemic story, then you can do it. Remember, my claim was, you can't get it from the two-dimensional models on the space of possible worlds. You can supplant it by an epistemic story, but then the epistemic story is doing all the work.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So you're not disagreeing with me, in which case you should be skeptical about the claims about 2Dism as well. Because the epistemic work is not being done by the model.
Yeah, but hardly anybody claims that.
Wow.
Dave doesn't. So.
Dave claims a number of different things. Who knows what the latest version says?
Well, I think he never said that we can reductively explain epistemic notions such as a priority in terms of an otherwise independently defined two-dimensionalism. I think he was from the beginning very clear that can't be enough.
Well, I heard him give papers where he certainly said that and would characterize the relation twice over as though it were doing the same thing. Once in terms of this two-dimensional structure on possible worlds, and another reading the epistemic significance of it. And when questioned, he was arguing that there would be a substantive argument to link the two. But maybe he's backtracked from that.
Dan?
I was also going to try and make an attempt to defend two-dimensionalism.
You're from Canberra too, is that right?
Yeah. defending the claim that the diagonal is the, you know, if it's true on the diagonal, then that's a priori knowable. But it's an a priori noble and a very ideal. And so I'm not sure if we could come up with any. So that's the claim. It's very
I can see that sort of line.
And then ethos, sorry, just to find as the negation. So maybe not the traditional use of ethos, sorry, just maybe this is the other. If it's not true on all the diagonals, it's not ideally ethos.
In that sense. Well, I there's a question of what we want from our idealization. You could say, there was a time I toyed with this strategy. Just say, here's a picture of rationally ideal. Okay, it's not exactly what we thought we were going to get out of the a priori, but here it is anyway. The problem with it is it fails to give. Fails to feed into the theory that we wanted from our theory of rational criticizability. Remember, it was the story about rational criticizability that was driving this story, and that I motivated the idea of the a priori in terms of. I wanted an account that made sense of the epistemic access that creatures like us could have. And there are debates we could get into, like, infinite tree inferences, etc. How idealized are we going to go? These are a real substantive questions. But what I think is clear is that if we want to get any purchase on that sense in which the notion of the a priori has got to play a crucial role in criticizing the rationality of someone who fails to endorse certain inferences, then it can't be the ones that just there are in no sense connected to what we think of as rational failings. So it's the story about rational failings that's driving the account, and the account that you offer isn't going to sit with that.
So part of this criticism that I think is not so much against the two-dimensional framework, but against coarse grain theory propositions.
So my account.
This sort of criticism. So any theory of coarse grain proposition is going to have a problem, like Stahl methods, for instance, and Frank Jackson is going to have this problem of deduction and so forth, given that proposition that 1 + 1 = 2 is the same proposition as some really complicated.
Yeah. See, I think that's not quite right, because I haven't mentioned propositions at all. Right. In fact, what I would be doing is not going possible worldish at all. My favorite way of doing consequence relations is on interpreted sentences and having multiple consequence relations on them that you can define. In which case, you can either be coarse-grained about propositions, take equivalence classes of them, or you can be more fine-grained, take self-evident equivalence classes. You have some degree of freedom if you go down that route. And also, I really don't think I mentioned in any point in this this story the word proposition, and that's because I don't think I'm committed by what I've said to any particular account of.
I suppose I was reading the two
additional
things, just how Frank does it, which is...
Yeah, that was in a negative bit where I was attacking another view, but that's not necessarily my view. I mean, I wouldn't be attacking it.
I've got a finger on this point. I've kind of lost the plot a bit, and I don't know most of the literature anyway, but this is just picking up on something that Wolfgang said. I mean, it seemed to me that what was important for you was the notion of the a priori. You weren't doing work with the a posteriori. So the question is, suppose you agree with the Canberra people on a kind of epistemic definition of the a priori,
Mm-hmm.
What does it matter what we call the rest of the stuff? All the things which are just the negations of the a priori.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to point out that, that's not the traditional a priori because the traditional distinction carves up the knowable stuff, and that negation has got the unknowable stuff in it as well. But what? How does that matter for your present concerns?
Okay, the crucial thing, remember, is that I say it doesn't. They don't. That distinction doesn't partition the same set. That means
no, but the negation. This is what Wolfgang points out. The negation partitions the set of all.
No, I deny that.
Well, it's a priori, or it's not a priori.
It's up. Well,
the negation has now got all the unknowable stuff in it. So a priori is a priori unknowable. Negation.
Okay, but then you need to show me that that the account of 2D a priori matches the epistemic a priori, right? And it's not obvious to me that that will be the case. It might turn out that that there are sentences which get contingent diagonals that are epistemically a priori because the worlds in which it goes false are relevantly irrelevant, right? So that still the diagonal is not going to do the work you thought it was going to do.
Okay, so it's going to be that sort of point which I think it's going to distinguish you from Wolfgang.
Can I have a point of clarification, just a quick one? You don't talk about propositions, but you talk about sentences.
Yeah, I did.
Aren't your sentences propositional statements?
Yes, but when philosophers talk about proposition, it's a term of art, and it's a term of some dark art, and it's what gets expressed by a sentence, and then there's a big debate about that. I prefer not to get into that debate right here. I have views, but I don't think those views matter for this debate.
Okay, are there any other questions? In that case, let's thank thank you all for coming. Let me add my thanks to Luca for organizing this meeting.